The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of Dartmouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A typical Norwegian cruise line package gives you a week on a floating resort with 4,000 other people also soaking up the sun and loading up at the buffet line. If you're willing to pay more, a lot more, you can opt for white tablecloths, a private pool, and round-the-clock butler service in The Haven, a ship within a ship reserved for the upper crust. Income disparity may have people riled up in the political sphere, but catering to the 1% is increasingly profitable for the travel and tourism industry. With wealth disparity in America greater than any time since the Gilded Age, comes a gulf in experience befitting that era. While on board the Titanic, metal grates kept the great unwashed confined. Today, it's electronic key cards and velvet ropes. Nelson Schwartz covers the economics for the New York Times business section. That's where we found his article, In an Age of Privilege, Not Everyone is in the Same Boat. And Nelson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here.
So Norwegian Cruise Line offers The Haven. What are some of the other perks luxury travelers can now enjoy?
Well, Royal Caribbean, sort of the arch rival cruise ship, they've got something called Royal Suites, which is sort of it's not a ship within a ship, but it's a separate zone, and you have your own restaurant called Coastal Kitchen. And what's interesting to me about it is when, the masses on the ship are on their way to the Windjammer, that's the sort of the familiar cruise ship place with all the buffets and tray tables and all that kind of thing, everyone crowding around, you literally pass by Coastal Kitchen with frosted glass windows when you're on your way to the mass experience, so you can almost push your face up against the glass and look in. And, what was very interesting to me is whether it's that or sort of when you go onto a plane and you kind of turn right into coach, but you look left in the first, marketers have found that that can actually, even if it stirs up a little resentment, it also can be an incentive for us to upgrade.
So envy increases sales.
Yes, exactly, which, again, it's sort of counterintuitive, and the companies themselves struggle. How do you, on the one hand, offer something, say, the amusement park that, people pay up to go to the front of the line or cut the line, whatever you want to call it. At the same time, you have to be subtle enough not to anger, the 80% who are not doing that. So it's a delicate balance, but if you want to grow, catering to the rich is where the money is.
Well, how much more does it cost for these kind of services?
It costs quite a bit more. For example, a room for a week in the Haven might be more than $10,000. This is for, say, a couple, versus, $4,000 or $5,000 in a regular, room with a balcony, a decent stateroom. So there's quite a bit of difference. If you want to go to Discovery Cove, which is the high-end version of SeaWorld, that can be more than $1,000 for a family of four versus several hundred at the more familiar SeaWorld in Orlando.
So it's at SeaWorld, on cruise lines, Walt Disney World apparently. So are they having any trouble filling these slots?
Not really. I mean, that's the key. And I think, one thing in reporting it that struck me, it's easy to kind of vilify the companies, but I think they're responding to a broader economic force, which is namely, everyone talks about the top 1%, really, but the top 10%, say, of people by income, they're the ones who have the most growth in disposable income. They have more spending money in their pocket. So businesses are going to go after them. The middle class wages have been largely stagnant over the last 20 years, and especially since the end of the recession. So, companies still need that 80% as their base, but if you want to grow, which is what companies and investors and executives get paid to do, you're going to have to go after the people with the money.
So why in the travel and tourism industry in particular do you think? I mean, which has become relatively inexpensive compared to, let's say, when our parents were planning vacations.
Sure. I think, the internet and big data and online sales have made it easier to pinpoint the wealthiest customers and or those who are willing to pay up for these kind of perks and privileges. I mean, there's just tremendous, you know, data out there. You can look at sort of frequent flyers. You can look at, you know, all kinds of market research to pinpoint these people. It was much harder when it was people who were going to travel agents or corporate travel departments.
Remind us of the data, if you don't mind, of the level of income inequality in the U.S. right now.
I mean, basically, you know, Emmanuel Saez is a, you know, very influential professor at Berkeley who's done a lot of work on sort of the 1%. And I mean, something like over 40% of the nation's wealth is now controlled by about 1%, which is up from around 30% 20 years ago. And, you know, the other, I mean, those, that's the data. I think part of it, too, is, you know, since the end of the recession, financial assets like stocks or real estate have recovered in value, whereas salaries haven't. So if you're someone who's got a lot of investments, which tends to be wealthier people, you're doing okay, whereas if you're just dependent on a salary, you're having a harder time. And I think those trends are what's driving this.
Well, the brands who are going for that top market, you mentioned Royal Caribbean, Norwegian Cruise Lines. Any sense that there's going to be, I don't know, a peak perk at any point soon?
You mean like people are going to be perked out?
Yes.
I don't see any sign of it. I mean, it's a reasonable question, but I think, you know, one thing, again, that was interesting and eye-opening to me as a reporter who covers economics was the sort of the psychological dimension of this, which is people like to feel validated. So it's not just the comfort of a bigger chair, say, in business class. The people like the idea that they're boarding first or that they're skipping those incredible TSA lines. I was not in business class. I fly coach for the New York Times. I was traveling for work on Sunday. The lines at LaGuardia were insane. Not only would it have been nicer to be in the fast line, but I think people get a psychological, like in French you say, a frisson just from passing by. And I think that appeals to people.
Yeah, but on the other side, you know, it certainly grates. I mean, the ideas of
yes.
brands playing off class differences.
Oh, yeah. It grated on me. I could have paid $30 to pay American Airlines to go to the fast security line, which I wouldn't just because this is not, it's not something voluntary that I was flying to Nashville on Sunday or it wasn't a pleasure cruise. But I think it definitely grates. But as you know, as I mentioned, I think they are aware the psychology of it sometimes can stimulate people to pay up.
Well, I'm thinking about what's going on the campaign trails right
yes.
now. You know, this kind of idea of, you know, egalitarianism, that
mm-hmm.
everybody should have the same chances. I guess a question out of this, do you see any kind of movement within consumers against this kind of favoritism to high rollers?
You know, I think there is a lot of resentment. There is a lot of frustration. I mean, I was amazed. My story got more than 2,000 comments on our website in a very short space of time after it went up. And, you know, a lot of tweets. I mean, some people are outraged, and then there are others who say, well, you get what you pay for, and I like my perks. So I don't know how much pushback there will be. I do think you're seeing the ramifications of this on the campaign trail, and it's not one party or another. I think you're seeing this in many people who are voting for Trump, and I think you're seeing in people voting for Sanders, that there's this frustration that, the, quote, the system is rigged and that the wealthy have too much power and that the class system has gone to too far an extreme. And I think you're seeing that bubble up among both Republicans and Democrats. And whoever the nominees are, I think they're going to have to contend with that.
Well, Nelson, thank you for speaking with us.
You bet. It's great to be here.
Nelson Schwartz, he covers the economy for the New York Times business section. And you find a link to read his article, In an Age of Privilege, Not Everyone is in the Same Boat, at wordofmouthradio.org. Pictures also are terrific in this article. All income levels, you can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The arrival of spring in Martha's Vineyard means the start of another season at the Flying Horses Carousel. Built in 1876, it's the oldest of its kind still operating in America. Tourists come for a ride and a chance to catch the carousel's brass ring. Islanders, however, play a different game with the goal of being crowned King of the Rings, and that's no easy feat. Producer Jonathan Earl has more on a local pastime that takes quick fingers and years of practice.
Before we start, I'd like to make a few safety announcements.
It's early May in Oak Bluffs. Ryan Camacho and Lily Tilton are taking their lunch break on the steps of the Flying Horses Carousel. Ryan's 14, Lily's 15. They talk about work, they tease each other. And before long, as it often does around here, their conversation turns to the ring game.
Some people get really into it, like especially the people who work here. They get really obsessed with it, like catching as many rings as they can, but...
Yeah, because it's fun. We have a ring contest.
It's fun.
It is fun. I think it's fun.
The thing you need to know about the Flying Horses is that it has a special feature, a ring dispensing arm. It sticks out from the wall like it's waiting for a high five, and at the end of the ring arm is a steel ring. Each time you go around, you grab a ring. You end up with a handful of them when the ride's over. But most people aren't really interested in the steel rings. They're after the one brass ring. It appears at the end of the ride, after the music stops. Catch the brass ring, and you win a free ride. People are just crazy about it.
There they go, the brass rings have been caught. Please meet them
again. There's another game, though, one of skill, not luck. It's played by local kids and carousel workers. The idea is to grab as many steel rings as possible. Not in one ride, mind you, but in one moment, a few seconds at most, as you whiz by the ring arm. The technique is simple, but it takes years to master. Okay, so this is how you do it. You stand up and hold onto a pole. Don't sit on a horse. As the ring arm approaches, lean forward to meet it. When you make contact, start hooking rings with your index finger, like you're pulling the trigger on a gun, until the ring arm is out of reach.
Grab, 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 grab.
Catch, 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 catch.
Do, 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 do.
There's no actual award for the person who catches the most. No free ride. The prize is sweeter than that.
You've got bragging rights, you know, for your whole life.
Skip Finley worked at the carousel in the early 1960s.
You can carry that mantle with you for years and years and years and years and years.
Beginners can usually pull two, maybe three rings at a time. Carousel workers, four or five. Only an elite few consistently pull six or more.
If you can catch six of those rings, that's a hell of an accomplishment.
Getting that good can take years of practice, summer after summer after summer. So what's the record? Well, nobody really knows. Documents are spotty, memories fuzzy, and old ring counts, let's just say they have a way of creeping up over time. In short, it depends on who you ask.
The most I ever saw, I'm pretty sure I saw Olivia Steele caught eight rings one day. That's an event that's hard to forget.
I've watched a lot of people pull rings, and there are some people that easily can do nine.
I believe it. That person probably has at least nine fingers, so there you go.
I don't know what the record is.
I've had over the years people tell me, oh, I can catch nine. That's complete bullshit. I'm sorry, there's absolutely no way they're doing that. Not so much because I don't believe it's humanly possible, but it's not mechanically possible. The rings only come out but so fast. And no matter what you do, they're not coming out any faster.
Hi, I'm Ian Chickering. I'm 20 years old. I worked for the Flying Horses for 5 years. I could catch seven rings at once.
Ian is the two-time champion of the annual ring-catching contest.
People would always ask me, how many have you heard of someone get? And I would say, oh, Jared, the boss's son, he would catch, you know, 11 or so at a time. But again, that's just like the rumors.
Jared Meter, and I caught 9 rings at the carousel.
Okay, so maybe somebody out there has caught more rings than Jared. But I haven't found this freak of nature yet. As someone who can pull at most 3, let me just say that 9 is totally insane.
It was an ideal situation when I got it. We basically had brand new rings going to the ring arm. The ring arms were just refurbished, so there was no rust, no grit from the summer all down in there. And nobody in front of me, nobody behind me. So everything was just like the stars were aligned, I guess, you know, the stars and the planets were aligned. And just started pulling. I used my pointer finger. And then when I was too far back, I knew I wasn't going to basically get any more than my pointer finger. I rolled my middle ring finger and little finger, just like rolled them through, and each one of them caught a ring, and I got my last 3. Everybody's like, 9, you know, and everybody said that. And I'm like, oh, let me count that again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, yeah, I got 9. I think I was a little bit stunned, but just also that relief, but also the drive of, okay, now I got 9, I got to get 10.
That was 25 years ago. Jared's tried a lot since then, but he's never gotten 10. He's never even matched his own record. Then again, neither has anybody else, which means that Jared Meter remains the king of the rings.
It's cool, but I actually look forward to somebody beating me. I'd like to see somebody actually put the time, effort, and skill and beat it. That'd be pretty cool. I'm not one to sit there and say, hey, I'm the champ. You know, so I'd like to see it. I'd like to see one of my kids get it. But, you know, anybody can get it. Yeah, but time to pass it on.
In Oak Bluffs, on Martha's Vineyard, I'm Jonathan Earle.
And from brass rings to other potential metal treasures, here in New Hampshire, when the weather heats up, it's time to go hunting for hidden gems. NHPR's Sean Hurley visited New Hampshire's largest metal detecting event and brought us this story.
Retired firefighter Mike Cogan from Long Island hoists a metal detector over his shoulder and heads down the dirt road with 40 other metal detecting enthusiasts from around the country.
Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go.
This is the third day of Bone 23, and this morning, with the property owner's permission, the group is scanning a five-acre field. Gene Risley, from Shelburne, Mass., finds a strong signal and is the first one to start digging.
I gotta tell you, I'm one that don't give up.
Butch Holcomb, from Atlanta, and the publisher of American Digger magazine, says the field the group is hunting once belonged to a colonial-era family.
And around colonial sites, you'll generally find what they call coppers, which are the old coins, 1700 coins, about the size of a large cent. You'll find household items. I found a solid silver thimble my first day here.
Such coins and thimbles, he says, old as they are, rarely have much value.
Actually, figured it up one time. In all the hours that I have metal detected, if I was to sell all my finds, it would come out to approximately $2.50 an hour.
So what's the draw, I ask?
This is as close as I'll come to meeting someone that lived 250 years ago. The last person that touched it was a colonial fella. And I call it shaking hands with the past is my own little term I use for it.
Gene Risley reaches a hand into the earth. No colonial fellows reach back.
At first it started like 4 inches, but as I took this plug out, it's down 6 inches, so I gotta keep going. Yeah, it's probably a tin can.
You find a lot of trash, is what they all say. Iron, bits of rust, old cans and nails. But everything is kept, and all the holes are neatly filled and fixed after each dig. Mike Cogan drifts his detector over the ground, finds a good signal, and shovels out a plug of grass.
And it's like pulling the handle on a slot machine. Boop, 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 boop. The wheels are turning. Boop, boop, boop. Oh, I got a signal. Boop, boop, I'm digging. Boop, 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 boop. Goose eggs. It's another nail. Yeah. Every now and then, it's a reward.
Matt Winchester hits a jackpot of sorts, finding a half penny from 1787.
Directly behind you in the field over here, probably about 8 inches deep.
Stacy Razov metal detects her way along a rock wall.
I'm surprised there's a lot of girls in this hobby.
About a quarter of the crowd is female. I ask Razov what advice she'd give to someone new to the hobby.
Now, you really should dig everything, especially when you're learning a machine. You should dig every solid, repeatable signal. Because I was doing that. I was digging beer can, beer can, beer can. Then we had a great signal, and I said, it's probably another beer can. We dug it, and it was a Sterling baby cup.
Gene Risley sifts through a handful of dirt.
Yesterday, I found a button really deep, and somebody else said, I never would have dug that thing. But I'm a digger. I don't care.
Nearby, Chris Redman brushes earth from a silver sleigh bell found 10 inches down. Moments before, and nearby, 11 inches down, he found a coin.
It's the 1700s, I would say. Probably a King George based on the thinness of it.
Redman finds another strong signal, digs, and comes up with a rusty sledgehammer head. He passes it to Jim Dore and Jay Verberg.
What do you think
that
is?
Yeah, that's a 5-pounder.
5?
Yeah.
What, is that like the same weight as a bag of sugar?
No way. That's more than a bag of sugar.
You think? Sugar. I carry 10-pound bags of Hamburg. This feels lighter.
That's like a weak 8-pound bowling ball.
There you go. Yeah.
Retired firefighter Mike Cogan looks over the field, the low mountains in the distance, and the 40 former strangers he now calls friends.
Look at this view. Look at the day. Look at the great people who are optimistic in the hobby that you love. So you hang out with people who are a little wacky, like yourself. You tell tall tales, and it's all good.
They may not get rich. They may not find anything. But as Butch Holcomb says,
it's a very mystic feeling to actually hold something that someone lost 200 years ago.
Gene Risley hasn't moved.
I'm determined. I'm even if it ends up to be a nail. Oh, you might have this whole place dug up. I could be here for a while.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The family farm is an American idol stretching from Pilgrim settlements to Little House on the Prairie to countless commercials of tractors thrashing through a sunlit field. They're the stuff of campaign commercials, symbols of honest, hardworking, conservative values for the right, and the values of localism and hand-hewn sustainability venerated by the left. Gabriel Rosenberg has a more complex view. In an article for the Boston Globe Ideas section, he points to the racism, dispossession, poverty, morbidity, and complex sexual relationships that are part of the nation's agrarian traditions. Gabriel Rosenberg is assistant professor of women's studies at Duke University, and welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
You open your article with this idea that family farms are central to American political mythology. What makes them such good politics?
Well, to a great extent, of course, it's because for most of its history, the United States was, to a great extent, an agricultural nation, and agriculture played such a central role in American economy through the 19th and into the early 20th century. And as a result of that, it has always been a part of American political rhetoric to flatter people involved in agriculture, either as laborers, as owners of farms, in some senses by talking about intrinsic virtue. And that goes back, of course, all the way to Jefferson and before, as people who sort of identified farmers in particular as the backbone of Republican virtue or of Democratic virtue in the American political system.
And the truth, how does that romantic version of the American family farm today differ from reality?
Well, the way I'm really talking about in the article is this notion of permanence and sustainability and the idea that what we see now in the countryside is the way it's always been. And in fact, non-metropolitan spaces in American history were incredibly diverse in a number of different ways, but also quite impermanent. And rural populations were quite transient. And American agriculture and rural spaces are actually, to a great degree, better defined by waves of dispossession and dislocation and migration, less so than the image of permanence that we have associated with the family farm. And so that's a long way of saying that we want to think about, for example, 19th century agriculture as a bygone sort of golden age when Americans really were sort of connected to the land in this deep and meaningful sense, and that now family farmers are inheriting this kind of heritage. But the reality is something quite different, which is that most 19th century farmers were not on the land for all that long, and they didn't necessarily stay all that long. They didn't think about their relationships to the land in terms of permanence, and the family structures that they maintained to be able to work the land were very, very different from the family structures that we associate with the family farm in the late 20th century.
Well, and of course, you look historically, and for most of America's history, farm labor was actually being performed by slaves. We know so much about the deplorable reality of that. What about the influence of slavery on the nature of America's farms and rural culture?
First and foremost, I think one of the ways to think about this is that slave agriculture in the United States was incredibly expansionistic. Again, there's a sort of a false mythology about the idea that slavery was dying out by 1860 or something like that and wasn't expanding. But in fact, you have to think about slavery as a system of land management within agriculture, and it was incredibly aggressive and it was expanding into Texas and into Arkansas and into the West as a whole. The effect of that expansion was incredibly trying and taxing, of course, on the family life of slaves, as if slavery itself was not such a destructive institution for that as well. But one of the things that we see, of course, is that there is a migration of individual slaves southward and westward. And as a result of that, you're seeing a lot of the destruction and sort of demolition of slave families. So in fact, for people who were working in agriculture and bondage, the notion of having a permanent relationship to a particular plot of land would be kind of farcical. In fact, they were being dispossessed and dislocated on a very regular basis, and par for the course, really, for the course of American agriculture and for the generation of capital and profit.
So that was southward and westward. But on northern farms, they were family-centric for the most part, but not the little house on the prairie or the Norman Rockwell painting kind of family. What was life like for them?
Well, I mean, life was grueling, you know. It was really just kind of bone-shaking poverty in most of these frontier communities and on the earliest sort of settler farms, right? And as a result of that, sort of in terms of impoverishment and in terms of deprivation, people developed family systems that were expansive, that were highly flexible, that were multi-generational, and especially as regards the gendered division of labor, were very interested in making sure that all the work got done, even if it didn't accord with middle-class sensibilities about what men should be doing, what women should be doing. And so as a result of that, on a lot of these northern farms, in particular these frontier farms, you saw women contributing a lot of labor during harvest, for example, but if need demanded it at other times of the year as well. And that includes doing labor in the fields and doing all sorts of labor that we generally associate with a sort of male farmer. At the same time, it also meant that men had to contribute substantially more to the domestic maintenance of the household than we would otherwise assume. And it also means that there were a number of chores and a number of tasks that were primarily accorded to women, but were still revenue producing. And that's things like produce, dairying, and poultry farming were all generally perceived as women's work. But above all else, flexibility was demanded. And that's to say that you had to be able to provide for this family. And that meant that you disposed of gendered ideals of labor if it was necessary for survival. And too often it was, in fact, necessary for survival because this was a grueling lifestyle. It was very, very difficult.
Well, one of the things that was most surprising to me in reading your article was, you know, the breakdown not just of traditional male-female labor, but also, as you said, the expansive kind of relationships. Casual, if quiet, bigamists were commonplace in frontier communities, you write. Sexual relationships that deviated from the norm. So what kind of sexual taboos were broken on farms across America, and why?
Yeah, well, I mean, for the point about bigamy, essentially what you have to understand is that in 19th century America, most states had very, very restrictive divorce laws. But there wasn't a really great way of tracking people as they moved from states to state. And it also was very easy for people to just change their name and assume a new identity in a new place. And so as a result of that, one of the sort of make-do solutions to the problem of divorce in the 19th century is that people would simply pick up and move. They would move out of state, they would separate, and they would create new families. And as a result of that, they never actually legally dissolved their prior marriages. And that's what I mean when I say that they have casual, if quiet, bigamists, was that if it wasn't working out, you might simply pick up and relocate elsewhere. And because we're really talking about this series of waves of kind of migrations, that's actually a very, very common experience, that the families that are being built in the Near West in the 19th century United States are sometimes composed of the remainder of other families that have been shattered, or some people chose to relocate, a wife chose to relocate and a husband chose not to, or a husband chose to relocate and a wife chose not to. On the other hand, as a result of that, and as a result of this sort of like churn of people throughout the American West, there's also a much more casual attitude as regards sexual propriety and sexual relationships. People still want to have sex. They may not be able to find sex within the boundaries of what 19th century prim and proper middle class morality demanded, which is to say that there's a lot of sex work, that there is a lot of relations between members of the same sex that we might describe in some senses as opportunistic. And in general, people had a very make-do sort of attitude with regards to sex in a lot of these frontier communities. So if you look back at the record, you find quite a significant amount of evidence for same-sex relationships, for sexual commerce, for sexual barter, and for living arrangements that really defy the sort of expectation of one man, one woman, one family.
The American family farm is the stuff of romantic images of permanence and sustainability and the stuff of campaign commercials and political speeches. Well, we're speaking with Gabriel Rosenberg. He's the author of the book, The 4-H Harvest, Sexuality and the State in Rural America. He's giving us a very different picture, historically, of America's rural life. So combating this, what they call degeneration and demoralization in rural communities, a social response, but also prompted a government response. What was that, and did things change?
Yeah, so absolutely. In the early 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt is sort of perhaps the iconic figure of what's called the country life movement in the United States. And it's essentially an effort to reform a number of different elements of American rural life. Agriculture in some senses, also social elements, but by and large, a lot of moral prescriptive elements go into it. And it produces, among a number of sort of different outcomes, in 1914, broad bipartisan support for what's called the Smith-Lever Agricultural Extension Act, which is the creation of a public agency called the Cooperative Extension Service, or the Extension Service, that has essentially a county agent in every county of America that's offering the advice and prescriptions of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And although a lot of it is agricultural advice, a lot of it is also advice about how to form families and how to teach children, for example, proper gender roles and proper attitudes towards sex. I write about this much more extensively in the book, of course, because 4-H, which is the topic of my book, are actually youth clubs that are organized by the Cooperative Extension Service, which is to say that the USDA organizes these youth clubs with the general notion that they're going to teach rural kids how to be healthy, prosperous, moral, clean-living rural citizens, much in contrast to the degenerate and sort of immoral or deviant rural occupants that the social reformers of a decade earlier had been so concerned about.
So did this shift from the disorderly rural image to the notion of a pure, pious family farmer, is that where that came from? And did it take hold?
I mean, that probably simplifies it a little bit in the sense that there had always still been that persistent agrarian rhetoric that had also been through the 19th century. And generally speaking, the rural reformers who were concerned about rural degeneracy were always tacking back and forth and saying, but it used to be so nice and good. We've got to get back to that. We've got to get back to the virtuous country farmer. And government support is the way to do it. But what they start doing really by the 1930s is that they start introducing particular language and particular imagery along the lines of what we now think of as the modern family farm, which is to say that they're making an argument that the government in particular is able to offer advice and expertise that will allow you to create a healthy, properly sort of orderly and sexually moral family. It's actually at that exact moment, really in the late 1930s, that the term family farm itself comes into parlance in American culture as a celebratory ideal. And frankly, the people who are making the argument for it earliest as a celebratory ideal are actually government officials. And they're using it as a way to rally support for New Deal era rural modernization programs.
Well, something we know now about farms in America or farming communities, outside of the monolithic farms, a lot of rural America is beset by poverty, addictions, a lot of problems. You know, we have more of that image of meth labs than of Morningstar farms, right? Is there something deeper in that behavior, in that culture, than the shiny, happy family farm vision that we get?
Well, I think the reality is that when you talk about rural spaces in the United States, many of them are post-industrial. Many of them are the result of post-industrial processes. And the people who are making do in those spaces are actually not working in agriculture. It's funny, they're living in houses that may be surrounded by fields, but they're fields that they don't have access to and that they don't work. They may be working many miles away in a retail job or something like that. And the reality of American agriculture is so very different from the mythology of the family farm. We want to think that most farms are worked by single families that are virtuous and have this deep connection to the land. But the reality of farming in the United States is that the overwhelming majority of labor that goes into American farming is actually done by wage laborers, and much of it by undocumented wage laborers at that, particularly if we're talking about produce agriculture and things like tobacco agriculture. And so when we talk about the problems of rural America, sometimes talking about this particular unit of the landed family farm, the happy, smiley kids and parents who are working together to keep a permanent relationship to the land, it actually occludes the sort of realities of life in a lot of these post-industrial spaces, which is that maybe people would like those opportunities. Maybe that's how they would like to live. But generally speaking, the political economy of agriculture and the way in which the American state has structured rural spaces doesn't really open that up as a possibility.
Well, Gabriel Rosenberg, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's been great. Thank you for having me.
Gabriel Rosenberg, he's assistant professor of women's studies at Duke University. He's also author of the book, The 4-H Harvest, Sexuality and the State in Rural America. You'll find a link to more on the book and to his article, Fetishizing Family Farms. All of that at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Schwinn bicycle has a rich history in New York's Puerto Rican communities. In many of these enclaves, members of riding clubs show off their stylish vintage bicycles, decked out with chrome, car horns, and flags. The tradition dates back to the first wave of Puerto Rico's mass migration to the U.S. in the 1950s. Producer Jack DiZadoro dug into this particular bike club history.
On a Saturday afternoon, a fully restored 1950s Schwinn bicycle sits outside a small garage in Bushwick, Brooklyn. The red, white, and blue of the Puerto Rican flag flutters overhead, and salsa rhythms drift out to the street from inside. Two men sit next to each other while coffee boils on the stove.
Eddie Gonzalez from Classic Riders. This is one of the oldest garages that exists from Puerto Rico Schwinn Club. Now it's owned by Roberto.
Bueno, mi nombre es Roberto. I love the Schwinn bicycle.
Roberto is one of the old Schwinn Club members.
Roberto migrated from Puerto Rico to New York. Eddie was born in the Bronx, but grew up there. They're both proud of their heritage. And they demonstrate this pride through their bicycles, built by the Schwinn Bicycle Company, which was founded in Chicago in 1895. Eddie was introduced to the bikes and the clubs 20 years ago when he first moved to New York. He was riding his mountain bike over the Williamsburg Bridge with his friends when...
And I said, oh my God, look how pretty they are. Me and my friend stopped. And I asked one of the guys, what does it take to join the club? And he goes, you have to be a Puerto Rican and have to also own a Schwinn bike. And I cracked when he told me that. I cracked up. And I went, yeah? And he goes, yep. So I said, okay, one day I'm going to get me one. And it didn't take much. It took me only a few months. You don't have a Schwinn, you're almost not Puerto Rican. There's certain neighborhoods, you know?
Mi nombre es Alfredo Rivera.
Alfredo, or Freddy as he goes by, is a Schwinn collector in Puerto Rico. He says the island's love affair with Schwinns began in the 1940s, when one store, just one, began importing bicycles en masse. Lucas Blanco and Company, in Old San Juan, was the first and only authorized Schwinn dealer in all of Puerto Rico.
De ahí en adelante fue que pues la Schwinn
comenzó. From then on, the reputation of Schwinn bicycles started to grow, and everyone wanted to have a Schwinn bicycle. The bike started to appear all over the island.
One model in particular was the most popular, the Schwinn cycle truck. With its large crate holder over the front tire, these bikes were made for work at a time when hardly anyone had a car.
Y con ella pues era que trabajaba. Mi bicicleta era color anaranjada.
I used the bike for my work. My bicycles were orange. I got a lot of attention because I remember then when I was delivering newspapers, lots of people wanted to buy it from me.
And the bikes are still highly collectible.
Tenemos de todo tipo de personas como coleccionistas.
We have people who are 70, 80 years old that arrive with their bicycle or arrive with a collection And we also have 14-year-old, 15-year-old young people who got involved in collecting bicycles. So we have people of all ages.
It's true. Go on Facebook or YouTube, and you'll find videos of moms riding vintage Schwinns through the streets of Puerto Rico. In America, it's different. When the Puerto Ricans began arriving to New York in large numbers, the bicycles changed. They got bigger, shinier, louder. They were no longer Puerto Rican, but distinctly New Yorican.
My name is Miguel Luciano.
Miguel is a Puerto Rican artist who has used the Schwinn bikes to tell the history of Puerto Rican migrants.
The bikes from this era, you know, the bikes from the 50s, they hark back to the memories of people's childhood in Puerto Rico. But then it tells you something about how people remember it in a specific location, how people then reimagine it in their adult life with that same connection to place, to our island, to our history, to our childhood.
Between 1950 and 1960, the Puerto Rican population in New York City more than tripled in a period known as the Great Migration. They brought with them a passion for Schwinn bicycles and, as Miguel says, a way to express their cultural identity.
The very process of sort of like re-signifying these very American sort of symbols or objects or icons is part of our own colonial resistance in many ways. I mean, that has been part of our experience, not just in the U.S., but even on the island, you know, for many, many years. So we find ways of, you know, Puerto Ricanizing the bikes, right?
Here's Eddie from the garage in Bushwick describing his first Schwinn.
It was a Jaguar, 1965. It had like so many things. It had like so many reflectors, horns, and stuff like that. And I started building the bicycle my way, like painting it my way and putting my own things on it.
But many of the original Puerto Rican Schwinn Club members have either retired or moved back to Puerto Rico. Eddie from Classic Riders has seen the old timers go and wonders what's next.
Over here is only like the old generation. The new generation is not into this.
Yeah. How about you?
Until my legs
ride
say so. Until my legs say so.
Whether or not the same nostalgia for Schwinns continues through new generations, well, the bikes are big and shiny and, most of all, beautiful. What's not to like? In Brooklyn, I'm Jack DeSidoro.
Thanks so much for listening today. We do have a quick announcement before we go. We've been working on an idea of an episode all about books, from the first kernel of an idea to selling the idea to an agent or a publisher, to self-publishing, to who writes those blurbs on the back of the final copy. Basically, how books today get made, and we need your help and your book pitches. I'm borrowing the idea from the New Hampshire Writers Project. You send us a short pitch for the book that you are working on or dying to write, be it novel, nonfiction, memoir, fantasy, whatever, and we will submit it anonymously to an agent from the Zachary Schuster Harmsworth Publishing House. Remember, a good book pitch is succinct, attention-grabbing, and makes you want to keep reading. With that in mind, email your book pitches of 150 words or less to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Put book pitch in the subject line. Again, wordofmouth@nhpr.org. It's kind of an incredible opportunity to cut through the slush pile and get the focus of a very fancy literary firm. So we encourage you to give it a try. And we'll need a few to share, so tell your aspiring writer friends. We'll put all this information up on Facebook and on Twitter as well. So pass it around. As we know, the best ideas travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too, here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.